This is a Collider.com audio interview.
So how are you doing today?
Me?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm tired. Are you kidding me? And this is, you know, my second, so I'm warming up.
You're
I had a phone call. I'm in person, so you can see the red in my eyes. But, you know, that's what happens when we do this the day after the premiere.
I was going to say, they combine everything together. In case you're not aware, I do a site called Collider. I've started now by introducing the site at the beginning of the interview rather than the end, in case you have no idea who you're talking to.
They told me.
Totally.
I was filled in before you came in.
So I'm going to do some fun questions and some generic questions, but
right.
I definitely have to start with, you know, why Hoover? What got you interested?
In Hoover? You know, it was someone I'd read a lot about. If you're a history buff, you know about Hoover. He was likely the most powerful man in this country during the century that we were certainly the most powerful country in the world. And if you start reading about him, I don't know how much you've read about him, but the books contradict each other constantly, and it's really clear that they're mostly written from a political perspective, or they have some sort of an agenda. And I was often left just with very little sense of the man personally. I had a sense of what he did and didn't do, and what people disagreed about, whether he did this or didn't do this or that, but I was like, why? Why? Why was he doing all of this? And that was my big question. Why was he after such power, and why did he hold on to it, and why did he hold on to it so long that he started to lose his moral compass, and he seemed to lose all sense of empathy, and so that, I wanted to see if we could answer that question, and thankfully it was on Brian Grazer's list of interests over at Imagine, and after a phone call to make sure he didn't mean the vacuum cleaner company, I was like, all right, well, let's look into it a little bit, and see if there's any there, see if there's anything that's more human than, say, the dress wearing or being married to the FBI, you know, sort of the most popular claims to date. And I found some things, and I thought, boy, let's pitch it and see if we can't try and tell this story.
It's interesting because this is a man who was in power for so long, mm-hmm. had so many people working under him, and as you say, so much contradicting information.
Yeah.
What do you think? You obviously researched Hoover far more than most people, obviously, and what do you think the reason is why there is such contradictions in terms of the man and, you know, everything from secret files to, you know, there's just so
right.
much about this man?
Well, he did do some of the more heinous things recorded in history in the 20th century. I mean, some of the people that he blackmailed, went after and called a communist, had... It made sure they were fired because they were gay, which seems awfully hypocritical. You know, went after Martin Luther King because of a grudge and started labeling him a communist. I mean, he did some of the most heinous things to some of the most beloved people in history. And on the other side, he built this crime-fighting organization that stopped some of the bombings and the domestic terror that was going on in 1919 and in the 20s and in the 30s. He really did do great good by expanding the federal powers so that these gangsters couldn't just drive across the state line and say, ha-ha, you can't catch me now, which is what they were doing. They would just skirt the state lines and was able to capture them and stop that crime spree. And so he did great good also. And he built an organization that still does good. So some people only look at the good stuff, and some people only look at the bad stuff, and they have very strong opinions about it. And it's funny, because I have very strong opinions on both sides, and that's what was interesting to me, is how can you have a man who could be so good and so bad, so brilliant, and then so dark? And is there anything about him personally that created this, that turned him this way, that led to this? And can we address it, and maybe it'll be helpful for this generation?
Something about Clint I've heard is that he sticks very close to the script.
Yeah.
That there's not a lot of, you know, he's on it. Did that sort of, for you, apply like a little added pressure to make sure all the commas and all the dialogue was exactly the way you wanted it?
Well, I do try to deliver a solid first draft, meaning it's my 10th or 20th draft, and then I call it first and hand it in. Much to the chagrin of the studio sometimes when they look at the contract and go, you've passed your deadline. But it, you know, it makes the second draft work all the easier. In this case, I didn't know it was going to be Clint, and so when I found out Clint was interested, it was both a blessing and a bit of, oh boy, there's some things I'd like to change still. And I'd heard Peter Morgan say that on Hereafter he'd had that feeling, but they were already shooting, And so, you know, I just started to talk a little bit with Clint about things I thought could be a little bit different. We did some fact-checking now that it was a greenlit movie, and that changed some things, which was wonderful, with the help of the FBI, actually. And then Leo was finding new recordings of Hoover where he had the best animal metaphors to describe criminals, and so we started to incorporate some of that language. And so I was actually able to make some changes. But it is funny because I went to Rob Lorenz and I said, hey, you know, we should probably cut a good chunk out of the first act. That's kind of everything in the kitchen sink. And he's like, well, we'll shoot it all and we'll see what turns out well. And I was like, well, God, only working with Clint and Rob Lorenz at Warner Brothers we ever, you know, hear that. And we did end up cutting a lot of those scenes.
Well, that's actually something I wanted to touch on. I was reading in one of these articles that the first cut was 3 hours, and obviously the release is 2 hours, 15 minutes.
Yeah.
So that's a sizable chunk of material that is on the floor.
Right.
Do you know if that material will end up on a Blu-ray DVD, or is that just gone for the ages?
Oh, I have no idea. You should ask Clint or Rob, might know that. But, you know, it was all stuff, I don't miss any of it. It was all, you know, things that I thought, it was different ways of accomplishing the same goal, oftentimes. And it was what Rob said, and Clint said, was, we'll shoot it all and we'll see which turns out best. And then it was, we kept the stuff that worked best.
So most of that was in the first act?
A lot, yeah. A lot of the cuts were in the first act. And then some of it was in the Bruno Hauptmann story. So there was a good many cuts there because at a certain point it was clear enough, and we didn't want the audience to be ahead of it. And so there were some cuts there about the investigation. So because, you know, how many ways do you have to prove him guilty? And there were a lot, and they were all very, you know, innovative, but you know, we stuck with wood and tracing bills and some of these other things.
I think there were like 2 or 3.
Yeah, they were
really
like,
focused on.
Yeah, now there were 2 or 3, but you know, in truth, they were like 10 or 12.
Talk a little bit about, obviously, people want to know how much, and I'm sure this is a hard question to answer. How much was quote unquote Hollywoodized? And yeah,
sorry, I just noticed your
shirt.
Yeah,
the shirt's really,
and it's so amazing.
I really like
that. That is an amazing shirt.
It's Banksy-esque.
It's fantastic.
Can you talk a little bit about how much was quote-unquote Hollywoodized,
uh-huh,
and how much, you know, is actual fact?
Sure.
You know, I'm sure that you can't get everything right.
No, I was there the whole time.
Exactly.
Yeah, I took a little time machine.
Right.
And
no,
I,
but I mean,
did an invisibility pill.
Exactly, but obviously, like, you need to create situations,
yes,
for a movie. But at the same time,
you
try to do it as best you can, I'm sure.
I mean, my thing, and it, you know, maybe it doesn't always make for the most interesting movie. Because I want things to be anchored in truth. And because I feel like, why make a biopic if it's not somehow helping us now? There's really no point. Like, if it's not informing how we could do things different now and maybe not repeat our mistakes, then why do this piece about this person or this event? And so, but that means, I think, anchoring things in truth. And so it's, you know, down to, say, the fight in the hotel room between these two. That was based on accounts of the people who shared the rooms around them. And it was common for them to go and share these suites. It didn't just happen once. And these fights were overheard. And so, you know, it's, I want it to be that anchored. And it's why I don't have them having sex in the movie. Because I don't know if they had sex. I don't know. What I do know is that with all the evidence that I found, and it's all presented in the movie, that these guys weren't straight. I mean, and so, you know, because they had every opportunity to get the hottest women in Hollywood were throwing themselves at these guys. They were dapper. They were handsome in the 30s. And in all these biographies, say from Dorothy L'Amour to Ginger and Leela Rogers, they talk about how they wished Hoover would have responded, and he didn't.
What about the...
Last question, sorry.
There's going to be a two-parter. Talk a little bit about the signature at the store. Is that a true scene, or is that?
That is one of probably a half a dozen accounts I read about how he got his name, and some of them are very dull. Like, there just was another John E. Hoover at the bureau when he started, so he made it J. Edgar. And others talk about who he preferred. You know, like, he preferred his mom calling him this, and da da da. And then there was that one about him trying to buy a suit, and his credit was bad, and so he changed his name there. And that, to me, was the most fun. But it was, you know, that one, still, there's that account, and it's one of many. And
yeah, that's a fun scene. And obviously, I'm going to ask you, what the hell are you writing right now? What's going on in your wheelhouse?
I'm finishing up The Barefoot Bandit, which is the feature on Colton Harris Moore. So I've been spending a lot of time in Seattle. That's almost done. And what an amazing kid. There's so much that people don't know about him yet. And it's heartbreaking and inspiring and has been a very emotional journey for me. And then once that's wrapped up in the next couple of weeks, I get to work on Under the Banner of Heaven with Imagine again, with Ron Howard directing. So, you know, Mormon fundamentalists. I'm going back to my Big Love days a bit.
I was going to say that's an interesting subject.
Yes, I think so.
Yeah, 100%. This is obviously after he finishes Rush.
Yes, yeah. So I'll be writing the script while he's doing all that. And it'll take a bit. I mean, I want to go into the Lafferty Boys murders, and that's in the book, but there's more there. And even according to Krakauer, he has more that I want to look into and read and meet the families. And, you know, same thing. I want to come at it and really try and understand it and not just have a good guy, bad guy sort of retelling of it.
I understand. You want to show the gray.
I want to show the gray. I like the gray.
Exactly.
Movies. I don't know if audiences always... It makes them work a little harder, but and they have to work hard in Hoover. But I think the gray, you learn more if you're willing to do it.
I agree. She's going to give me the hook if I don't wrap.
So all right, wrap it up.
I'm going to say thank you so much, and congrats on the movie.
Thanks, man. Very much.
I'm sure Leo should be buying.